Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What was life like for American women when Betty Friedan was writing The Feminine Mystique? For many of the white middle-class women to whom it was directed, Friedan's searing social criticism seemed to hold a mirror to their frustration and ennui, their sense that there ought to be something more for them than simply defining themselves as mothers and wives. In fact, in 1963, women were still considered second-class citizens in most workplaces if they could get hired at all. There were no laws against sexual harassment or marital rape, and in many states, women couldn't take out loans without the permission of their husbands or their fathers. As Friedan clearly understood, as women gained greater and greater levels of education, they began to long for more freedom and control in their own lives. Stephanie Kuntz is Director of Research and Public Education at the Council on Contemporary Families, and she teaches history and family studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. Her new book is called A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. Stephanie, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
I think it's really interesting that this book is interesting. It's important to read. Not your favorite book to read in the world.
No. No. It's kind of a funny story about how I came to write it, because the publisher suggested that they'd like to write a lot of books about biographies, not of individuals, but of famous books. And they said, why don't you write a biography of The Feminine Mystique? And I said, oh, that would be wonderful. And, I would love to reread that book. I just had this vivid memory of having read it. And when I sat down to read it, I realized, oh, my gosh, I've never read this. And although the first few paragraphs are very stirring and touching, there's a lot of it I don't like. And then I thought to myself, why did I think I had read it? And, of course, it was because my mother had read it and loved it and used to call me every week at school and tell me, you know, how great it was. You know, I'm in my 18 or 19 rolling my eyes, but it evidently stuck. And then later, when I got out into the real world after college and realized how many problems women still faced, I read excerpts or I listened to people talk about it, and I began to believe that I'd read it. And the funny thing was, Chris, that when I first started trying to interview women and men who'd read it, I got a lot of people who wrote to me and said the same thing, that they were sure they'd read it, and when they told me what was in it, I knew they hadn't. But I ended up with 180 women and men who had read it at the time, and I began to really appreciate what she did for this one layer of women who read it back in the 60s when things were so different than they are now.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating because this was a generation of women that was, in fact, better educated than their mothers and grandmothers could ever have dreamed of being. But in many families in those days, the expectation was that the real goal of college was to get the famed MRS degree.
Yes, I came to think of these as a set of women who were caught between two worlds and would literally, maybe to mix metaphors, have slipped between the cracks if it hadn't been for her. Back when women first won the right to enter colleges at the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century, it was still considered very radical, very unconventional for a woman to want any education at all. So women who entered college then were already sort of committed to challenging the gender stereotypes. A lot of them remained single afterwards. A lot of them joined professions. They were much less likely to drop out of college than men because they came in so committed they'd had to fight for it. Well, in the post-war period, suddenly sending your daughter to college, sending your kids to college, was a mark of having arrived in the middle class, and this became a big aspiration. The men were sent to college to become better breadwinners. The women were sent to college to catch better breadwinners. That was called getting your MRS degree, your Mrs. degree. And what was interesting is that women who went to college then became twice as likely to drop out of college as men. And the fear was, if you didn't get your MRS degree, your bachelor's degree would be a personal fate that you'd be sentenced to for life. So these women were going to college, getting a little exposed to education, dropping out of college, having read in college all the new psychiatry theories that, in fact, the normal woman wanted nothing more and the ultimate pinnacle of her happiness would be to retreat into a home of her own with a good breadwinner and a son she could be proud of and a daughter she could teach housekeeping skills to. And these were the ones who read that it's abnormal to want anything else, and yet when they did retreat this way, they were, as Friedan opened her book, and I take the title of my book from her first paragraph, she said that all over the world there was this, all over the country, there was this strange stirring, this sense of yearning among women who thought that they should have achieved everything they wanted, but were secretly asking themselves, is this really all?
That's what's so interesting, and I think it comes into perspective reading your book, that Friedan didn't necessarily create this. She just crystallized something that was already there, but people felt like if they told their best friend wouldn't relate, when in fact their best friend probably felt the same way.
Well, exactly. This problem, Friedan did not discover this discontent and this yearning. In fact, physicians already had a name for it. It was called the housewives syndrome. And if any of your...
That name.
What?
That name is horrible.
I know, but it was the housewife syndrome. Irritability, crying for no reason, all of these kinds of symptoms. If you've ever watched Mad Men, on the first series, Don Draper's wife, Betty Draper, drives off the road because her hands have gone numb. This was one of the symptoms of housewife's syndrome. It was a very accurate portrayal of it. But Betty Friedan was the first to say, this is not a disease. This is not a question of something that needs to be treated in you to make it go away. It's a symptom of the fact that you're a human being with normal yearnings for something in your life, not in opposition to, but in addition to your satisfactions as wife or mother. So she was the first to really make this popular, to put it in the terminology. In some ways, she was the first self-help book for modern women. She said, you're not alone. Your neighbors are feeling this, and you're not crazy.
So she described something that was real and that was quite common, at least among, let's say it here, middle-class white women was who she was writing to and about at this point. But she, the mythology of Betty Friedan is an interesting thing that we ought to talk about here. I think a lot of people at the time seem to have perceived that she was one of them, that she was sort of, forgive the air quotes here, just a housewife when this all occurred to her. But in fact, she'd had a very active political and professional career.
Yes, this is, you know, one of the things about Betty Friedan that is a slightly disillusioning and that I had to get over before I began to really appreciate what she did and what a great boon she was to so many women. She tended to reinvent her history. Betty Friedan, or her maiden name was Goldstein, had been a brilliant psychology student at Smith College, and that was where she had developed many of her critiques of Freudian theories about women, which were just really hitting their height in the 40s. She was also, after she graduated, she worked for labor union newspapers, and she wrote there about the plight of oppressed workers. By the time she was writing this book, she was leading a desegregation study in her, struggle in her own neighborhood. When she was at Smith College, she had been a major supporter of this big student movement to help the union maids in the dorms organize and have a union to support them. So Betty Friedan knew about all these other issues. But at some point in the early 50s, after I think her second child, she either lost or was fired from her labor union job. Her husband, meanwhile, was moving up in the post-war economy. They moved away from their old neighborhoods into ones that were a little more suburban. And she began to try to be a homemaker. She really did try to become a homemaker, but also found herself discontent, started trying to write freelance magazines for the women's magazines. So by the time she wrote this book and had come up with the idea, first of all, I think she didn't really want to talk about that left-wing union labor history because you were still in the midst of McCarthyism and the tremendous, tremendous suspicion of anybody who had been associated with anybody who had been associated with anybody who'd known anyone in a left-wing organization. But also she was trying to solidarize herself with her readers. So she herself created the myth that I'm just a housewife like you. And I think that's sort of sad, although it's not entirely, I don't entirely condemn it. I understand why she felt compelled to just focus on the piece of her life that could relate to her audience.
Well, and it makes sense in a way that readers would be much more drawn to someone who said, I'm just like you, and here's what I've decided, as opposed to, here's what you ought to do, because I've been out in the world and I know better.
Well, exactly, and that's why politicians today pretend that they come from working class roots and are outsiders, right?
So let's talk about this. The limitations on women's freedoms in the early 60s and before were not strictly social. Talk about some of the legal prohibitions that surprised you.
Oh, my gosh. It's just a stunning world to those of us who live today. This was a period when people think homemakers had it better than working women. In fact, in 1963, only 8 states gave a wife any legal claim to her husband's earnings or property. Those were community property states. But even in those states, the man could have the final decision about what could be done with it. He could even leave part of the property, as she could not, to someone else. You know, here we have this joint house. I'm leaving half of it to someone else. In the rest of the states, the only right a woman had, a wife had, was the right to be properly supported. But in fact, that gave husbands a lot of leeway. One Kansas woman who didn't want a divorce, but did think that her husband, who was a very comfortably off farmer, who had plenty of running water in his workspaces, ought to give her running water in her kitchen. So instead of asking for a divorce, which he would not have gotten, by the way, because of the fault but she asked that since she has a right to be properly supported by law, he should install running water in her kitchen. The Supreme Court agreed with him that property support didn't cover running water. most states had headmaster laws. For example, the man could decide where the family lived. And if a husband decided to move the family and the wife refused to follow, he could charge her with desertion and get a false-based divorce. So there were no protections against marital rape. Domestic violence was not taken seriously. Women who wanted to work had to turn to the help wanted female section of the newspaper. It was perfectly legal to not hire a woman because she was a woman, not promote her because she was a woman. That didn't change until the 80s. No laws against sexual harassment. That didn't change until 1993. She could be paid less than a man. She could be fired if she married or had a kid, or even in some industries, like the flight attendants industry, if she gained a few pounds or turned 30. That was considered over the hill.
And in fact, it was also perfectly acceptable and happened all the time that people would advertise they wanted not just a woman for a particular job, but they wanted a pretty girl for a particular job.
Oh, yes. I went through the New York Times ads of 1963, and I have to say, I sometimes felt like I needed to pick my jaw up off the floor. They would sometimes advertise for college grads, but it was always accompanied with the demand for good housekeeping skills. And one employer, and he had several ads this way, so he must have been particularly demanding, said in his job advertisement, "You must be really beautiful."
And at the time, I mean, women might have bristled at this. We don't want to act like women thought this was totally normal and okay. They just didn't think there could possibly be a change.
Yeah, you know, sometimes they didn't like it, but really most women sort of were convinced that this is just the way the world operated. I know my husband told me that when he first got his first job in the 1960s, he talked to a woman secretary, but she was the manager of the secretarial pool, and she said to him, "Oh, I get really good pay for a woman." So it was taken for granted that a woman would have different rights and obligations. And all, you know, when you look at marriage advice, boy, I'll tell you something that curls your hair, is to look at marriage advice manuals of the 50s and 60s, where they told women that any problem they had in their marriage was really probably their fault. If your husband's unfaithful, do you keep your house clean enough?
Let me have you stop there. We need to take a break. Stephanie Kuntz is my guest. Her new book is called A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stephanie Kuntz. She's Director of Research and Public Education at the Council on Contemporary Families and author of the new book, A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique in American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Before the break, Stephanie, you were telling us that women were advised that whatever problems might exist in their marriage were clearly their shortcoming and their fault. It must have been even tougher on women who either chose not to marry or didn't find the right person to marry, because that was, at the time, sort of the one key to respectability for a woman.
Absolutely. There was a poll in 1957 where 90% of Americans said that a woman who didn't choose to marry, or a man, too, who didn't choose to marry, was either deviant, neurotic, or even pathological. So there was this huge sense that you had to marry, that you were not respectable if you weren't married. And interestingly enough, you had to marry early. If a woman wasn't married by 22 or 23, she was already being labeled an old maid.
Hmm. What did Friedan have to say about people who didn't choose to marry because they were attracted to the same gender?
Well, unfortunately, she didn't take this as a serious problem. As a serious problem because that they weren't allowed to have these lives. She took it as a serious problem that you were attracted to the same gender. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that really grates when one reads The Feminine Mystique today. She actually accepted this widespread Freudian idea that was very prevalent in the 40s and 50s, that it was overprotective moms. And incidentally, what a mixed message. You know, you should be a housewife, you should invest everything in your children and your husband. But if you invest a little too much in your children and husband, you're going to emasculate them and turn your sons into homosexuals. So Betty Friedan actually accepted this. She tried to turn it on its head. She said, well, if you're concerned about overprotective moms, you know, smothering their kids, maybe we should give them some other outlet for their interests and energies. But actually, when you read her sections on homosexuality today, they're very cringe-inducing.
Why was she writing only to and about white middle-class women?
Well, and this is a puzzle, of course, because as we talked about earlier, she did have a history of thinking about the needs of working-class women and African-American women. But I think that by this time she had been writing to the women's magazines, and she discovered a niche, just like marketers, you know, will pick a niche. And the niche that she found was these middle-class women, or incidentally, often working-class women who were just moving into the middle class, who had it better than their mothers or grandmothers. And she was finding that these women were tremendously disoriented. They didn't face the same physical, material hardships as working-class women, or the racism that black women faced. They faced a more intangible and in some ways more bewildering sense of prejudices, because they were told, here, you've had it better. They knew themselves they had it better mm-hmm. than during the Depression and World War II and their mothers and grandmothers, and yet they were unhappy. And so she said, I can help explain to these women why they're unhappy and why it's not their fault. So she did some niche marketing there.
One really remarkable conclusion that you come to in this book is that in the early 60s, a lot of working class and African American women, in fact, at least within their own families, not in the broader society, had more equality than their white middle class neighbors.
Well, yes, just out of necessity. Lots of household budget studies have shown that despite being in some ways talking more macho, that working-class men, and particularly black men, often did more housework just because they had to. You know, when you didn't have the appliances, sometimes that housework was too much for a woman. And also that, particularly with African-American women, that there was a tradition of them being co-providers outside the home and having more influence at home and more respect at home. You know, a lot of people think that it was white feminists who came up with the idea of the dual earner marriage. This was a tradition in the black community, and not just a sad tradition of necessity, as some people think. Black and white leaders of the 20s, 30s, and 40s often talked about how important it was for a woman to have what they called a tripart identity, as wife and mother, as co-provider for the family, and as community activists. And I'm not saying there wasn't sexism in the black community. There certainly was. But there was more respect for the roles that women played in the community and at work. And so these women, I think, found themselves in a different situation. They were not getting that constant message that the only thing that can make you happy, the only interest you're supposed to have, is right in your own kitchen and bedroom.
So Friedan missed what seems to us in 2011 a perfect opportunity to hold up this segment of the American population and say, see, this is working here, and they're still wives and mothers, but they're also working outside the home, and they have these other identities. Do you think, though, that in 1963, especially in huge swaths of this country, there would have been white women who couldn't have looked at an African-American woman and said, what a great role model for my life?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, it's a shame from our perspective, and it's a shame also because that she didn't even mention it. You know, I think that some women could maybe have heard this. But no, I mean, her niche marketing, you know, it's repulsive that you have to have these niches, but it was absolutely true in the 60s. You know, if you've watched the show Mad Men, the casual racism of the time was so, so pervasive. So I think it's probably true, sad but true, that white women wanted other white women to identify with.
My guest is Stephanie Kuntz. Her new book is called A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. You can join our conversation by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Athena in Dallas. Hi, Athena.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You actually kind of answered my question a little bit, but I remember I took a women's studies class in college, and Betty Friedan's book was assigned to us. And I'm a black woman, a product of parents who went to college in 1967, 68. And I remember being really angry after I read that book.
Yeah.
And I think now I look back on it and listening to what you're saying, I realize that I felt like Betty Friedan was leaving my mother out. You know.
Absolutely.
And also because I think my mother's focus, because she was a black woman, was a little bit different, rather than she wanted to go to college to get an education. But I think it was also because she had that opportunity as a black woman. It was a little bit different. And so I wonder what Betty Friedan would say now about these black daughters who are products of those women who went to college in the 60s, who are now very successful and unmarried, and what she would think about that.
What do you think, Stephanie?
Well, I think her views evolved, and she had actually started out, as I said, a supporter of civil rights. So I think she'd be very, very happy. And, you know, when I completely agree with you that there are sections of the Feministique that are just, painful to read today. For example, at one point, she talks about how if you want to go out and get a job, that's fine. You know, you can hire somebody else to do your housework or take care of your kids. And, of course, that's black women she was talking about.
Yeah.
So I understand the pain and anger. On the other hand, I do think we need to recognize that when Betty Friedan, with black feminist Polly Murray, wrote up the Statement of Principles for the National Organization for Women just 3 years later, when it was founded in 1966, they specifically did emphasize the special needs of working-class women and African-American women in particular. So I think she would be very happy now. But she was, that book itself, I totally understand why it made you mad.
Stephanie, talk about this, the immediate reaction to the book. I guess people read it. It spread like wildfire. Were there book clubs at the time that women were getting together and saying, yeah, some of this makes sense to me? Or how did people then communicate with one another about what they had read?
Well, of course, there were more newspapers in that era being read and more magazines than today.
Sure.
Her publisher was able to sell the rights to one of the major book clubs, so it was getting out all over the country that way. And the biggest, I think, important thing for getting the publicity out was that the two most influential and most widely read, and they had a much bigger readership than today, women's magazines of the era, McCall's and Ladies' Home Journal, both published excerpts, which is actually unprecedented. You know, any author has to, if you're going to get excerpted at all, then you have to choose which one, because competing women's magazines won't publish the same thing. But both of them did in January and February of 1963, and to allow it, the publisher postponed the pub date. So I talked to people who said, yes, I picked this up at the beauty parlor. I was reading it in the beauty parlor. And course, some women were outraged. Some women have said, you know, I'm perfectly happy. What are you talking about? But then these other women who were not perfectly happy had this huge wave of relief. And we look back at it. I have to say, Chris, when you read The Feminine Mystique today, there is nobody who would disagree with it. I don't care what your politics are. All she said was that, in fact, she titled the first excerpt from her book that appeared in Good Housekeeping a year or so earlier, "I Say Women Are People Too." You know, and that's sort of like, duh. But that sounded radical at the era, and some of these women had never heard it. So there was a wave of relief among some women and a wave of indignation about some among some women and a lot of men.
Another thing that's really interesting is that for Dan, you know, women entered the workforce in greater numbers after this book was published. And some people said, well, for Dan, they assumed that she was about people having more stuff. And in fact, that was something she was really trying to guard against.
Oh, completely. And she also wasn't a careerist. I mean, one of her only concrete proposals in the book was she assumed that most women would drop out of the workforce for several years to raise their kids. And she said, why don't we have a GI Bill to reintegrate women into education or jobs if they did this? So she wasn't a big careerist. She did say, if you do want to work while your kids are young, here's the evidence that suggests it will not hurt them and it will not hurt your marriage either. And she turns out to have been right about that. But also I'm sorry, I was so excited to tell you that I forgot where I was going. That's embarrassing.
That's totally fine. Well, let's talk about this. The divorce rate did, in fact, climb through the 1960s and 70s and into the 80s. Was that a direct response to the issues raised by this book?
Oh, thank you. Now I know where I was going, and it relates completely to what you said. Women were entering the workforce long before Betty Friedan. They were driven out of the workforce immediately after World War II, but then they were invited back in, not at the equal pay and the male jobs that they had been able to get during World War II, but only at supplementary low-paid jobs. So women had already started to enter the workforce. What Friedan did was encourage some of the educated women to think, well, you can look ahead just being a secretary. It's okay to be a secretary, but you can look beyond that. And she also predicted that marriages would be better when women and men were more equal and could share breadwinning and family life. At the time, everybody thought she was crazy, and you're right. When women first entered the workforce, there was a big rise in divorce, both because of changes in the law that made it easier to get a divorce for marriages that had been going wrong for a long, long time, but also because there was a lot more conflict between women and men as they were negotiating new roles. But in the long run, it turns out Friedan was right, that today divorce rates are lowest in the states where more wives work outside the home. Back in the 1960s and 70s, if a wife took a job, that destabilized the marriage. Now it stabilizes it. And the lowest divorce rates and the highest marital satisfaction is among families where the men and the women do some sort of sharing, maybe not totally equally, but some sort of sharing of breadwinning and health care, and who have actually adopted these more egalitarian ideas.
Having read this and really studied it at the age you are now, what did it reveal to you about your parents' relationship that you hadn't understood before?
Well, you know, I had understood some of my mother's frustrations. As I said, she used to call me at college and talk to me about this. But it really... And I was so glad that before she died, I had already begun to take her oral histories to learn about her past and to sympathize with her. But there was also just this pang of regret because she was gone. And when I really learned just how deep the prejudices were facing my mom and all of the women like her, and what courage it took to take little baby steps, like saying, I'm going to go take a class. Mm-hmm. it's just painful to look back at. You know, the other thing that's painful, though, Chris, is to recognize my dad was a great dad in many ways, but not so good a husband. And it turns out that's very typical of men of that time. They were very eager to have their daughters participate in their upward mobility. Mm-hmm. But you know the way my dad did it to me and encouraged me? He would say things like, here's a problem. Your mom can't solve this, but you can. Hmm. And now I look back and I just shudder and I think, oh, how wonderful of Mom to love me anyway, despite the fact that my dad had encouraged me that way.
And I would imagine for a man of your father's generation, and I don't know your father, but it didn't occur to him how disrespectful he was being?
No, it really didn't, you know. It was like, this is what wives do, but we're on an upward course and my daughter will do better.
And a lot of women wanted that for their daughters as well. They said, well, I might be happy here, or I can live with this, but I don't want my daughter following in my footsteps.
What you say is fascinating, Chris, because just a month before the Feminine Mystique came out, there was this Gallup poll in the Saturday Evening Post that purported to show that American housewives were the happiest people on earth. Of course, you and I would just faint at what they called happy. They said, a man needs to be the boss, a woman needs a master-slave relationship, whether it's at work or in marriage. But they did say they were happy.
Mm-hmm.
Only one interesting thing, 90% of these so-called happy women said that they would urge their daughters to not get married so early, to get more education, to get a job, not to do what they did. So there were these simmerings of discontent that Friedan actually put her finger on.
Did women recognize that discrepancy, or did they maybe, they had so made peace with what they expected to be their lot for the rest of their lives that they didn't see it?
I think a lot of them did recognize over and over again. The letters to Friedan at the time and in the interviews that I took afterwards, some women had said, I had concluded it was too late for me.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't change my husband. I didn't want to leave him. I can't change my life, but I'm hoping my daughter will be better. And others were saying, oh, my goodness, I have these new opportunities. I'm going to use them not just for myself, but to give my daughter new opportunities.
Stephanie Kuntz is my guest. She's Director of Research and Public Education at the Council on Contemporary Families. She also teaches history and family studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. Her new book is called A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. We'll resume our conversation with Stephanie in a moment. If you would like to get on the line to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can also write an email and send it to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stephanie Kuntz. She's Director of Research and Public Education at the Council on Contemporary Families and author of the new book, A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We should talk about this, Stephanie, because you don't think that the feminine mystique in the same form exists today, but it does take on some more fragmented but still powerful iterations in the modern world. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. The old feminine mystique that you should play dumb to catch a man, that you mustn't ever win at a game with him, that you mustn't aspire to so-called masculine occupations, that's all pretty much done. But there's this tremendous mystique that I call the haughty mystique, that yes, young women are told you can do all these things, but you must constantly display how hot you are and how sexually interested you are and how sexually, quote, empowered you are, something that Friedan would have said was not really a form of empowerment. So there's that pressure on young women, and boy, as we know, it's starting younger and younger in girls. And then there's another feminine mystique that comes into play, not when a woman marries, as it did in Betty Friedan's time, but when a woman has a baby. And that is this idea that children need to have every moment be a teachable moment, and that it's your responsibility to just completely cultivate them. Actually, today, working mothers spend more time interacting with their kids than stay-at-home mothers did back in the 60s. So this mystique is you've just got to devote yourself constantly to this, and if you can't give the kind of constant time and learning experiences that we demand, then you should opt out of work. So then mothers are played off against each other, stay-at-home mothers versus working mothers, and of course men are left out of the equation entirely. So I think these are two new kinds of feminine mystiques, and in addition there is the persistence of the masculine mystique. It's okay for women to aspire to things that used to be called guy-like and behaviors that used to be called guy-like and to like guy things, but it's not okay for guys to do the reverse, and they face tremendous prejudices. And the ones who have adopted new values, like the men who want to do more housework and childcare, it turns out that there are so many pressures on them at work not to do this that men now report higher levels of work-family conflict than women do.
And I guess part of the assumption is that a mother with children, everyone understands that she will have to occasionally take a sick day to take care of not herself but a sick kid. But men are expected to have wives to take care of this sort of thing.
Exactly, exactly. And I've talked to so many men, I've taken their oral histories and done focus groups, and they will say that they actually pretend they have a doctor appointment rather than they have to leave work early because it's their turn to pick up the kid. So they feel very stigmatized.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Jan on the line in Mansfield. Hi, Jan.
Hi there. How are you this afternoon?
Great, thanks.
I just wanted to say I was a bride in 1962, college-educated daughter of a single mom that worked. And in 1963, we tried to buy a house, and I would not qualify on the loan because I was of childbearing age. I made more money than my husband did. I was stunned. I had always been raised to believe you could do anything you wanted to do, and that's just the way it was in 1963.
How did you deal with that, Jen? Were you just devastated, or were you...
I was floored. I just couldn't believe it. And their answer was, well, if you can prove to us that you cannot bear children,
then
we will put you on the loan.
Wow. Stephanie, can you imagine something like that?
Well, I can, but only because I've read the laws. This wasn't just, you know, one bad bank.
Yeah.
That was the policy. You had to be either 40 or prove that you were sterilized.
Can you imagine a bank asking you for that information now?
Stunning. It's stunning. But, you know, in those days, a woman also had to have permission to from her husband to rent a place. There was, as late as 1972, there was a case in New York that finally overturned this, where a woman whose husband was in a mental institution had to have his written permission to take an apartment lease.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go to Uma in Arlington now. Hi, Uma.
Hi. I was going to make a comment on, you know, the conversation that we're all having now.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to say that we grew up in the 1960s in India, and my mom was a single mom with a very good career, which was totally unheard of in that society at that time.
Yeah.
And so she got a lot of flack from other members of the family and even some friends, like, why are you educating your daughters? They are girls. They're going to get married. So it was totally regarded as a waste of her money for her to be educating girls when they're going to get married. But her thing was she made us make sure not just high school, both of us, me and my sister, got a master's degree. And my question is, do you think if any of these women that we are talking about in the 50s and 60s were forced to have a career, my mom was forced to work due to circumstances, and she ended up having a very good career. So if that had happened to any of these people, do you think it would have been a good thing or a bad thing for the women in those times?
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Stephanie?
Well, I think that we actually have studies of the 50s and 60s, and we know that women who had had jobs tended to have much higher levels of self-esteem and self-confidence than full-time homemakers. They even assessed their childcare skills more positively. So in many ways, it was good for them. But, of course, they faced tremendous obstacles and harassment, as we talked about. And it's interesting that Uma talked about how the flack that her mother got for sending them to college. This was also true in the United States. I had so many women told me that they got to college, and then they asked their parents, I would really like to go on to train a little further. I'd like to get a master's degree. And very often their parents would say, oh, no, that would price you out of the marriage market.
You know, clearly, Stephanie, women in this country are better off thanks to the feminist movement and the changes that have happened. Do you think men are better off, too?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, men today explicitly say that they're happier than they did in the 1960s. It's taken the pressure off them in many ways. First of all, they don't have to be the sole breadwinners. It means in many cases that a man doesn't have to stay at a job he hates or take a job he knows he's going to hate because he's going to be the only one in his family working. And we also know that as men have gotten more access to family life, they are reporting themselves more satisfied with their family life. Many men have learned that it's a wonderful joy to participate in child rearing. And in fact, that is why men are reporting, I mean, ironically, that sounds sad that men are reporting higher work family conflict, but it's because they have more interest and take more joy in family life now than they did in the past. And I just want to say one quick thing I discovered in my interviews that was really ironic. Women would have this crisis when they got their home, their good provider, and their children, and then they would say, is this all there is? Men would tend to have it even later, and in some ways more tragically, at a time when there was nothing they could do about it. And that's when they retired. They got their gold watch, they've got their pension, and then they'd find that they were strangers to their children and their wives. And many men told me that it was just horrible. They went into horrible depression about it.
Yeah, because they'd crafted their entire identities based on work and being that provider.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Jacob in Dallas. Hi, Jacob.
Yes, this is me.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment that, you know, in this day and time with the way that the economy is, you know, if you can picture it, be it in the 50s or even today, if you had a mom that was, you know, full-time at home, taking care of the household, taking care of, you know, the chores, if you will, the laundry and, you know, running the daycare and raising the child, and then if she decided, you know what, I think I want to go to college full-time, she would be revered. However, if you switch that out with the male or the man of the family, as the case with me, everybody has a completely different connotation. They'll actually say, well, what's wrong with them? However, if it was a female, they'll be like, oh, great for her, you know, and, you know, that's what basically happened to me. I graduated from Collin College, and then now I'm a full-time student at TWU because I couldn't find a job, and we had a daughter. Well, she is an RN. So I had to stay at home. And the sad thing is her friends, even in this day and time, still are saying, well, what's wrong with him? How come he doesn't have a job? And it is. It's very frustrating, you know, to be the male, be at home, be a full-time student, plus take care of a child, and then have a lot of people and you know, in the community say, well, what's wrong with him? So I just want to kind of bring that up and actually – well, you know, that is happening even today. You know, I can understand maybe in the 50s.
Yeah, no, Jacob, I appreciate your call. And I would argue, I don't think everybody thinks there's something wrong with you, but I understand the perception completely. Do you want to comment, Stephanie?
Well, completely. And this is a good example of why breaking down these gender stereotypes is good for both women and men, so that men are not regarded with suspicion or contempt when they do that. I do think it's happening. I do think there's much more respect for it. But I think it's absolutely true. As I said earlier, the masculine mystique is holding on. And so there are these mixed messages that men are getting. Just like women got in the 50s and 60s, the mixed messages, now it's men who are being told, help more with the kids, enjoy your family, support your wife's career. But, ooh, gosh, are you really competent to stay home or competent if you stay home?
We have an email here from Carolyn who writes, I often feel resentment to the women's movement because now we can work but are often still expected to care for the home with cooking, cleaning, shuffling kids' activities, etc. Sometimes I wish I could be paid to be a housewife.
Well, you know, I certainly think that's true, that there is this added pressure. But I have to tell you, I don't want to push my book too much. You can probably find it from others. But if you go back and read what women faced when they didn't have any pressures to do it all, in some ways it was worse. But the big problem, I think, that with the pressures we face now is what I call in the book, and a couple of other sociologists have named before me, is the career mystique. And this is the idea that the only good job you can have, the only one that will pay medical care, the only one that will pay a decent salary, is one that is full-time or more than full-time. And that is a problem because it puts too much pressure on the person holding down that job. Americans work longer work weeks and longer work hours than any other Western industrial country, and including Japan, you know, the former leaders in workaholism. And I think the way to solve that is to cut back on work to get better family leaves, because if we solve it by going backwards where women take care of everything, we are denying men access to family life and kids access to their fathers. Somehow we've got to get a better balance here.
What's your theory, Stephanie, about why in this country we think of ourselves as really fully equal in most places, and yet our family leave policies are really very small compared to the rest of the developed world, I should say?
Well, it is stunning how small they are. Every Western European country and most industrial countries in Asia as well have subsidized parental leave so that it's not a class privilege to stay home with your children when you need to. And they also have much longer leaves. Here we have 12 weeks unpaid leave, and if you work for a company with less than 50 employees, you're not even entitled to that. So that's just I'm not quite sure why we don't see this as a much bigger social problem than it is, that both men and women can get together on, because every other major industrial country understands the need to give parents, male and female, more time with their kids and more flex time. So we have equality if you want to just compete, but we don't have equality in the sense of the access to balancing work and family life.
Where do you imagine we go from here? What will American family life and the balance of labor and chores and responsibilities look like in 20 years?
Well, the responsibilities part, I can tell you, has been moving really much more toward equality. As late as 1980, 30% of wives said that their husbands did absolutely no housework at all. That's down to 16%. There are many, many households where the division of chores and child rearing is equal. In other households, women do more, but not half as much more as they did 20 or 30 years ago. So the motion there is going toward more sharing. The problem is that there's a certain point at which two full-time workers cannot hold down three full-time jobs. So instead of predicting the future, we have to change the future. If we stay as we are, more and more women and men are going to get burned out. If we actually begin to recognize that work-family balance is a legitimate goal and a right and a need for our kids as well as our adults, then we can live in a much better world in 20, 30 years.
Stephanie Kuntz is Director of Research and Public Education at the Council on Contemporary Families, and she teaches history and family studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. Her new book is called A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. Stephanie, it's been an interesting conversation. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Chris, I enjoyed the conversation. Thanks.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.